I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
As Haitian police take refuge in their stations, too scared to patrol the streets of some Haitian cities, President Jean-Bertrand Aristide has repeated that he will not step down to end the country's two-week-old bloody rebellion. So far, 60 people have died in the uprising to oust the Haitian president, who most recently was returned to power in elections widely considered to be flawed. Well, Paul Knox covers Haiti for Toronto's Globe and Mail newspaper. He joins us now from Port-au-Prince. And Paul, can you tell us what is going on in the streets of some outlying cities like Gonaive and Cap-Haitien?
Well, some of those towns are very different from the situation here in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Gonaive, I was up there last Saturday, and it's completely in the hands of this rebel gang that used to be called the Cannibal Army and now calls itself the Artibonite Resistance Front. It's really kind of a mess up there in the streets. They've littered the streets with rocks and debris, old rusted-out car hooks, and so on, the better to stop the police from trying to be able to retake the city. But it's actually not too bad in terms of food. I actually saw food being unloaded there, sacks of flour, cooking oil, and so on. The medical situation was desperate, though. The hospital was practically empty, and there was a lot of talk of people who had been wounded in the fighting who couldn't get medical attention. Now, I haven't been up to Cap-Haïtien, but all the reports we're getting from there is that it's kind of like an armed camp. It's in the hands of the government. The government supporters say they expect a rebel assault at any time. However, we've also been hearing that for quite a while. The fact is, I don't think anybody's really sure exactly what these rebels are up to. There's a lot of confusion about the situation, that's for sure.
Well, Paul, you recently interviewed President Aristide, who blamed this uprising in part on racism?
Well, that's right. I spoke to him yesterday at the National Palace, and he, of course, alluded very strongly to Haiti's long, long history of not only military or armed coup d'etat, but also the fact that this is a country where the vast majority of black people have long been dominated both economically and politically by the light-skinned, often known as mulatto, elite. And he very much believes that the nonviolent political and social opposition here in the capital, Port-au-Prince, is directed largely by members of that elite who are just expressing in perhaps a slightly different form the same kind of racism that the vast majority have known for the country's 200 years of independence.
And as you write, President Aristide himself is a very dark-skinned man.
Well, that's correct. He is from a poor family up in the southwest of the country and definitely represents the aspirations of the vast black majority. He also, I think it's fair to say that, after the Duvalier dictatorship fell, he was one of the people who was most effective in pushing for not simply to replace the Duvaliers with another dictatorship, but to finally give this vast majority of Haitians who never really had the ability to express themselves politically the means to do so, through elections, through a transition toward a real functioning democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul.
Now, of course, a lot of people. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, we only have a few seconds left. Just in a couple of seconds, how tense? I mean, some people are thinking this is we're on the brink of civil war in Haiti.
I think that it'll be a long time before the rebels can actually mount an assault on Port-au-Prince.
Yeah, Paul. Well, Paul, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Paul Knox covers Haiti for the Toronto Globe and Mail. Well, we turn now to James Dobbins of the RAND Corporation think tank, former ambassador to the European Community, and President Clinton's special envoy for Haiti from 1994 to 96. And Ambassador Dobbins, as you know, today two Florida senators are calling for U.S. intervention in Haiti. Democrats Bob Graham and Bill Nelson of Florida say they're afraid of a flood of refugees to their state. And they have history to back their fears, don't they?
Oh, certainly. I mean, Haiti is close enough, so it's a sort of an overnight raft ride away from Florida. And as the situation there deteriorates, there is always the chance that we could have massive outflows of refugees. In the months leading up to the American intervention in 1994, we were getting several thousand asylum seekers every day.
Can you briefly remind us, we've reported much lately on Haiti, but the U.S. has a complicated relationship with this country.
I mean, for 200 years, the United States has alternated between occasional brief fits of intervention and concern and prolonged periods of neglect.
What are the current schools of thought on U.S. intervention in Haiti?
I think the Democrats realized that their own efforts in the end didn't yield the results that they had hoped for. The Republicans, I think, also recognized that their policy, which was the diametric opposite of the Democratic policies, have not improved the situation either. I think everybody's rather chastened. I think everybody's rather disillusioned. I think there is perhaps finally an opportunity for a bipartisan consensus on how to move forward in Haiti. But at this stage, that consensus doesn't include a U.S.-led intervention.
Well, you write in today's New York Times that, in fact, the Bush administration had been seen as flirting with a coup in Haiti.
Well, I said that Colin Powell has corrected any apprehension or maybe misapprehension that they were flirting with a coup by clearly stating that in its U.S. policy that Aristide, who is the only freely elected official in all of Haiti, should remain in office.
Right. Your piece is titled A Way Out for Haiti. What is that way out?
Well, I think that the United States' influence in Haiti has been divided. You've had a distinctly Democratic and distinctly Republican policy. I think if the United States can compose a bipartisan policy in Washington, then we have some hope of promoting a reconciliation in Haiti, a reconciliation that might avoid the necessity of deploying troops.
But you say that Mr. Aristide should serve out his term, which expires in 2006. How is that possible, since he is such a lightning rod?
Well, he's a lightning rod, but he's also not only the only legitimately elected official in the government, he's probably still the most popular person in the country. So flawed as Aristide is, and I think everybody would now agree that he is deeply flawed, he may be the only element of stability left.
But some might say, how can you give any money to Haiti when it might be misappropriated by a corrupt government?
I think you're going to have to take that chance. I mean, we've been, for decades, even the Clinton administration was providing funding to Haiti through NGOs rather than through the Haitian government. And the result is the Haitians have no institutions. And you can't govern honestly, fairly, or competently without institutions. We're going to have to start helping to create those institutions, even recognizing that some of our money will be misspent.
Mm. And finally, you urge the United States to get directly involved in this impasse in Haiti. Is the U.S. perhaps too overextended right now to do that?
Well, we're certainly too overextended to take on a new military intervention. I certainly think we're capable of walking and chewing gum, and I think we could launch a diplomatic initiative vis-a-vis Haiti while continuing to carry out our responsibilities in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I do think that only the United States has real influence there. It's fine to involve the UN, the OAS, CARICOM, but unless the U.S. can get involved, and it can get involved on a bipartisan basis, I think the situation there is going to continue to deteriorate.
Ambassador Dobbins, thank you.
Pleasure.
James Dobbins, Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND Corporation, and also President Clinton's Special Envoy for Haiti from 1994 to 96.
The Bush administration has distorted scientific fact to make it fit policies it supports. So says a new report by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a science and environmental advocacy group. In the new study, the UCS alleges that the administration censored its own scientists, stacked advisory committees with political appointees, and refused to seek independent scientific advice. Administration officials accept that there have been individual problems, but reject any notion of a systemic problem. Well, Kurt Gottfried of Cornell University is the chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. He joins us now. Welcome, Professor.
How do you do?
Professor, Dr. Alan Bromley was science advisor to the first President Bush. He's now a physicist at Yale. He called the UCS report politically motivated. He said the statements in it are sweeping generalizations for which there's very little detailed backup. Can you give us a couple of specific examples of spinning science in the second Bush administration to make it fit a predisposition to a certain policy?
Yes, it's very well known that in every instance where climate change comes up, the administration has succeeded in suppressing information about climate change or distorting it. There's a famous case which was well reported when the Environmental Protection Agency was issuing an annual report which had a chapter on climate change. The White House demanded changes in the chapter. It asked for the suppression of scientific data. That's a well-known case.
Yeah.
This is not an isolated case. The same thing has happened with respect to air pollution and mercury contamination from power plants. Again, the Environmental Protection Agency was not permitted to issue their report, and in two instances here, people inside EPA leaked the report to the press. That's why we know what they concluded, which was contrary to what the administration was hoping to hear.
Professor, won't every administration cherry-pick, to a degree, what it wants to hear?
Every administration has political agendas, but this is not a set of isolated incidents. These are a large number of incidents. There's a pattern here. It cuts across virtually every department in the government. And that has not been true in the past. It certainly wasn't true when the first Bush administration. And the big distinction we're making here is not the policies that the administration is adopting. Administrations have to always take many factors into account beyond science, economics, political support, all sorts of things. We don't expect administrations to always act on the basis of scientific advice.
Mm-hmm.
What is new here is that the administration is distorting the input from the scientific advisory system. And furthermore, when it has a policy that it is pushing, it distorts the scientific information and knowledge related to that policy.
Dozens of scientists involved in the commentaries now on the Bush administration in science, but the Union of Concerned Scientists would certainly be considered by most a left-leaning group.
Well, we have been known to criticize the Clinton administration quite mercilessly for some of its policies, so I think that's an unfair characterization. There are 60 scientists, it includes 20 Nobel laureates, presidents of Caltech, the Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute, deans of medical schools. These are people who do not run out and sign statements like this.
What is the impact in human terms when an administration bends scientific fact?
Well, I think that we have examples of that in the whole area of power plant pollution. The Nixon administration and the first Bush administration passed legislation which has been extremely beneficial for public health. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of prevented deaths from air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
This administration is now fiddling around with the evidence on air pollution. Eventually, that does cost lives.
Kurt Gottfried of Cornell University is the chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Professor Gottfried, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, it's election eve in Iran. There's huge political unrest. So why is only 10% of the country expected to vote?
And later in the show, journalists as villains in new plays and movies.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's here and now.
When Iranians go to the polls tomorrow to elect representatives to the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, the biggest question isn't who will win, but who will show up to vote. After weeks of extraordinary political standoffs between hardliners and reformers, Iranians are reportedly fed up with both camps, and some experts think turnout tomorrow will be paltry, around 10%. Iran's moderate president, Mohammad Khatami, practically begged Iranians yesterday not to boycott the elections, saying that would only help the hardliners take over the government. Scott Peterson is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and a frequent contributor to Here and Now. He joins us from Tehran. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
Well, let's review quickly what's happened in the last few months leading up to tomorrow, starting with the conservative Guardian Council barring many candidates from even running in tomorrow's election.
Well, I think that was the initial surprise. Almost half of the 8,000 candidates that were initially put forward were rejected by this Guardian Council. Since then, we have seen one of the most dramatic political crises in Iran's in the 25-year history of Iran's Islamic Republic. And basically what we've had happen is the supreme leader having to intervene, ultimately not making much headway. And tomorrow we'll have, on the day of the election, there will be just 5,500 candidates that will be running, but there's not much in the way of reform candidates. And so basically a conservative victory is all but certain.
As you say, Ayatollah Khamenei tried to get the Guardian Council to back down, and he couldn't. And now, as you say, there aren't that many reformist candidates running. And in the last 24 hours, there have been some extraordinary developments. Tell us about a letter that was sent to the Supreme Leader.
Well, this letter to the Supreme Leader was one that was questioning his ability to run the show and to rule Iran. It was an extraordinary letter because what he says and his decisions are the ones that govern the entire state and the political system, and it is really the final word. The fact that the Guardian Council, which is also an unelected conservative body, was basically able to neglect the advice of the Supreme Leader is something that really does shake up some of the reformists in this country and even some of the moderate conservatives, because it really is a bold exercise of power. On the other hand, when we see the reformists taking an unprecedented step of basically accusing Iran's supreme leader of acting out of step with the Iranian people and trampling on their democratic rights, then that really is meaning that there are people who are not in favor of the Islamic system and also who are willing to see it dramatically and fundamentally change for the first time in a quarter of a century.
Well, and as you say, it's so extraordinary that only two newspapers dared even publish that letter because it's a criminal offense to be critical of the Ayatollah.
That is correct. And both of those newspapers, in fact, now have been closed for the time being for basically going against orders not to print that letter.
So Scott, what happens now? As we said, the more moderate president has been begging people to vote tomorrow, saying we must fight with all our might to defend religious democracy. What happens to that religious democracy after tomorrow's vote?
Well, it really depends on who you speak to. The reformists, of course, are in despair. They know that they're going to lose, and they know that basically the reform movement, at least as they are defining it, is at an end in Iran. There's no question about that. It's been an extraordinary 7 years. The political landscape in Iran has completely changed. In fact, it's changed to the point that the new Majlis, the new parliament, is probably going to see the conservatives will rule there, but what we will begin to see now will be a big division among the conservatives themselves. You will still have the hardliners, but on the other side, there will be more moderate conservatives who are basically taking on the mantle of the reformists. They are speaking using the same words and then making the same promises in many cases that the reformists used to make. And of course, the one thing that can get in the way of this entire process is if such a small number of Iranians vote, there could be a crisis of legitimacy for this new parliament.
Right. Scott, you write of the extraordinary divisions between the two sides in this country, almost as if it's two countries. On the reform side, you have the secularists who wear hip-hugging clothes and lipstick, and on the other, you have the devout.
Well, that's right. You have these other Iranians who are unrecognizable compared to the hardliners, and these are people who are very westernized. They really protest in the way that they wear their clothes, the way that they reveal their hair. The women, for example, wear very, very tight manto, as they're called here, you know, quite revealing. There's not very much left to the imagination after that. You've also got kind of other things that these people do that you simply would not find among the hardliners. I mean, some of these people drink, which is forbidden. Many of them, there are boys and girls that are mingling all the time. They go to parties. They listen to Western music. And these are the kind of things that lead to clashes between these two groups because the hardliners feel that they must somehow control this type of behavior because they feel it's un-Islamic. And meanwhile, the more westernized people are saying, we simply exercise a different kind of Islam. Our Islam is not the same as theirs. And so that's why you've got this incredible divide in modern Iran.
Do you think that some of the hardline, as you call them, the shock troops that roam the streets, the volunteers and the vigilantes, do you think they're going to feel more emboldened after tomorrow's vote when it's expected that the hardliners will win more seats in the parliament?
Well, this is a good question. In some cases, they may feel more emboldened, but they also recognize that even if they win the parliament tomorrow, there is still this huge popular upswell against their type of rule, to the point where some analysts are actually predicting that there's going to be a calming influence once this conservative parliament takes control, because basically that the conservatives will no longer feel as threatened. They may be able to begin to be magnanimous. And also, and we've seen this dynamic in several different countries in recent years, the hardliners are the ones that can exact change.
Scott Peterson, thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, covering the Iranian elections and speaking to us from the capital of Tehran. You can link to Scott's latest article by going to our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, when a fun night out turned into horror, we look back at last year's inferno at the Station nightclub, which killed 100 people.
And we'll visit an exhibit of African-American dolls and see why it's especially powerful for older black women.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Anti-Semitism in Europe is the subject of a day-long seminar today in Brussels, sponsored by the European Union. There's growing concern about attacks on Jews and Jewish symbols in Europe. We're joined now by David Twersky, Director of International Programs for the American Jewish Congress in New York. And welcome, Dan. David.
Thank you.
A vast subject, this, anti-Semitism in Europe. As concisely as you can, what evidence is there that anti-Semitism is on the rise in Europe?
The new problem is that there's a, I would say, a double new problem. While the radical right, you know, old-fashioned anti-Semitism hasn't been totally extinguished by any means, there are two new massive phenomena. One is the left in Europe is vitriolically anti-Israel. I don't mean they favor peace now over Ariel Sharon. I mean, there are a lot of Israelis who are like that. I wouldn't say they're anti-Semitic because they disagree with the Sharon government. But these are people who are vitriolic. They don't think Israel has a right to exist. And the criticism of Israel at some point morphs. It blends into and feeds upon anti-Jewish feelings generally, number one.
59% of Europeans saw Israel as a threat to peace in a recent poll.
That's a perfect example. Now, you have to think, what did they mean by that?
Yeah.
How could they possibly think that North Korea is not a threat or Iran is not a threat and Israel is a bigger threat? And the answer is they believe that if Israel would only not exist or if Israel would only stand down and not assert itself, Islamic rage against the West would subside. And therefore, Israel is the greatest danger to peace because through its self-assertion, it's dragging the whole world into a confrontation with the Islamic world.
And it does seem that some of the anti-Semitic actions in Europe are being committed by Arabs in Europe.
A tremendous amount. And that's the 800-pound elephant here, because no one wants to come off as a racist and say, because you're from a particular country, we don't want you, which is something certainly Jews would be the last people to endorse because it was used against us all the time. Fact is that what's happening in the United States with the massive immigration of welcome immigration of Hispanics into the United States, South moving into the rich North, is happening in Western Europe with the South being Arabs from North Africa moving into the rich North being Western Europe. So, for example, in France, just to give your listeners an understanding, there are a large Jewish community of almost 600,000, but there are over 6 million Muslims. I think that the key here is that people who want to become Europeans have to understand that becoming a European also has a certain sense of values that you're supposed to imbibe. Tolerance, pluralism.
What do you hope to come out of this seminar today held by the European Union in Brussels?
Well, we're hoping that the European Union will do two things. One is that it will vigorously oppose manifestations of anti-Jewish sentiment, and two is that they will play the international diplomacy game, even when they are critical of Israel, with a sense of proportion so that their criticism of Israel looks like normal relations between states and not something that's, you know, they're making up a unique set of rules just to punish the Jews. I do want to mention one thing that, I mean, I never thought I'd live to hear this kind of thing. The chief rabbi of France got on the radio in Paris 2 months ago and advised young Jewish men who were religious, Orthodox Jews, who wear yarmulkes, skull caps, not to wear them in public so they shouldn't attract attention. And what he said was, wear baseball caps. Don't attract attention to yourself. Wear baseball caps because you're going to get beat up in the street. The real meaning of this seminar in Brussels today, the European Union seminar, is that the European Union is saying, yes, there is a problem of anti-Semitism. We are recognizing this problem. It is real. We are no longer in denial.
David Twersky of the American Jewish Congress. He's director of their international programs and joined us from New York. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Refugees in the Netherlands are considering staging a hunger strike after the lower house of parliament voted earlier this week to expel about 26,000 failed asylum seekers, many of whom come from the former Yugoslavia, Chechnya, and Somalia. The plan is expected to also pass in the upper house and would give the Netherlands one of the harshest asylum policies in Europe. Well, joining us on the line from The Hague is BBC reporter Geraldine Coughlin. And Geraldine, does this vote in parliament come as a surprise?
It came as no surprise. It really was widely expected that the government's bill would be backed by a large majority. There had been a debate in Parliament a week before, and during that debate it became really clear that the Minister for Immigration had absolutely no intention of backing down. MPs were calling for a wider pardon, especially for rejected asylum seekers who've been living here for more than 5 or even 10 years. They were also calling for a reconsideration of the most urgent cases. So in general, even those in favor of the minister's bill were asking for a softening of stance. At the same time, there were more than 2,000 people protesting outside Parliament.
Well, you mentioned some of the objections, and I'm thinking that refugees who've been waiting for their asylum status for 5 or 10 years have full families at that point.
What happened was, under the previous centre-left cabinet, immigration and asylum restrictions were much more lax, and these people had several opportunities to appeal their cases, and that's why they became so firmly established in the Netherlands. Then they became integrated, had to go to integration classes and citizenship courses. They've had children who have been born here and only speak Dutch. So in that respect, a lot of these families and people feel Dutch, and they feel that because the government has let them stay here for so long, now they have a right to build their lives here.
Now, you said that a majority of the Dutch people are in favor of loosening some of the immigration policies there, but we find it interesting that some of the anti-immigration voices are from what you'd think of as the left. Their fear is that immigration, especially from Muslim countries, might undermine gay and women's rights.
Well, there have been a lot of calls, really, for a stronger integration policy for people coming in from Muslim countries, because there are some voices here in the Netherlands that do feel that the Islamic ideology does undermine women's rights as well and gay rights. So this is another thing that we're being confronted with here, is if people come to the Netherlands, then they have to fall in line with the Dutch culture and Dutch habits.
How is the plan that's being voted on expected to work if it's passed by the upper house as well? Are these 26,000 people expected to leave immediately?
The Minister for Immigration wants them to start leaving voluntarily, immediately. She wants the first batch to register with the local councils within 8 weeks to say that, yes, we're willing to cooperate and we're ready to go home. Then there'll be another 8 weeks for those who are unwilling or unable to return home to register with the councils to say either they don't want to go or they can't go back, for example, if they don't have the right documents, to places like Chechnya, for instance. Then after this 16 weeks, the government is going to take steps to place the rest of the people in four large departure centres that are to be set up in the main cities here. And then I think that we're going to see some tension in different communities where people are going to be forcibly taken out of their homes.
Geraldine, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Geraldine Coughlin is a reporter for the BBC. She spoke to us from The Hague.
Well, still to come, our theater reviewer looks at plays and films inspired by journalists who make their stories up, including Stephen Glass and Janet Cook.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Well, we received a lot of criticism for our conversation last week with the Wall Street Journal's Dorothy Rabinowitz, in which she called candidate John Kerry's rhetoric grindingly self-righteous. Peter Cohen of Newton, Massachusetts writes, "Why retain such obnoxious political commentators on your show? Dorothy Rabinowitz is 10 times more self-righteous than John Kerry."
And we received this note from Brent Esmoyle of Helena, Montana. "You mentioned John Kerry's appearance at an anti-war rally with Jane Fonda. I thought everyone knew this photo was fake. You should check Snopes.com before running a story." Well, Brent, we did check the urban legends website, Snopes.com, and as they point out, there are two photos of John Kerry and Jane Fonda going around. The one we were referring to, with Kerry sitting a couple of rows behind Fonda at an anti-war rally, is genuine. The one with two of them at a podium is a digital fake.
Well, our story on the report from the Demos organization on the dramatic increase of elderly people carrying huge credit card debt prompted lawyer Thomas Friedman of Dedham, Massachusetts, to write about a client he represents. So we called Tom to find out more.
I have a lady who's in her early 70s, who's a retiree, has medical and dental bills, and to make matters worse, over a period of some 2 to 3 years, she acquired approximately 15 credit cards, two or three from the same company.
Oh, man.
One can look in their mail and see the envelopes come in day after day saying, "Purchase a new card for no annual cost." And then if you look at the fine print, which most elderly people need a magnifying glass to read, it talks about all the financing charges and the increases in the interest rates to these usurious rates if you don't make the payments on time. And over approximately a year and a half, her debt flew up to $80,000, Bill.
Our representative, Tom, from the Demos organization that we spoke to about this, suggested that elderly people be given lower interest rates. Would you support that?
I do believe that would be a great idea. I think it would be very easy on an application for a credit card to get a profile that would certainly identify the elderly. They should be prevented from being subjected to these insane, unreasonable rates.
Tom, thanks very much.
Okay, Bill, nice to talk to you.
We also spoke earlier this week with playwright Tony Kushner about his new work in progress, in which a fictional Laura Bush reads Dostoevsky to dead Iraqi schoolchildren. Kushner said it wasn't meant to be a savaging of Laura Bush, but he did express his own anger about Bush administration policies. Well, Steve Mangan of Newbury, Massachusetts, had this response: "I'm disappointed that the writer artiste was given a voice on Here and Now. Instead of allowing him to spout invective under the guise of art, silence would be more effective. I do not support the war, nor do I support President Bush. But I also do not support putting this artiste on the air and in my home."
Ellen Steinbaum thanked us for a conversation with Tobin Bradley, a military advisor explaining concepts like discrimination and helping Iraqis hold elections in one province in Iraq. One 29-year-old respecting the Iraqis' right to choose for themselves and make an election happen. Tobin Bradley is someone I'd like to hear more about. There's important work for him to do when he comes home.
Well, as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Journalists as the bad guy, the villain, the sneak, the plagiarizer. There's been a cast of such characters in the news in recent years. The New York Times' Jason Blair, The New Republic's Stephen Glass, and a little further back than those two, The Washington Post's Janet Cook. So it's not surprising that now books, movies, and plays are featuring such characters to a degree perhaps never seen before. The new play, The Story, is one example. It's by playwright Tracy Scott Wilson and is inspired by the Janet Cook story. The play is now being staged at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, Connecticut. Here and now's Bill Marks has seen it, and he's here to give us the straight story. Bill?
You got it. The straight scoop, always for me, Bill.
Bill, remind us what the Janet Cook story is all about.
Well, the Janet Cook story is a very famous instance of plagiarism where a young black reporter for the Washington Post won a Pulitzer Prize, supposedly given by talking to people who were living in the ghetto in Washington, and it turns out that it was a made-up story, and the characters that she featured were fictional.
This is back in the 80s.
This is a ways back. But the idea of ethical, let's say hanky-panky goes back far in journalism. This was a particularly interesting story, I think, to the playwright of the story because it was a black reporter who did it. And I think that what's interesting about this play is that we already are familiar with sort of the ethical problems in journalism, and this combines those problems with racial issues and racial tensions in the contemporary newsrooms.
Tracy Scott Wilson being a black playwright.
Right, and a very interesting one, actually. And she wanted to start out to be a journalist and then ended up not pursuing that career, but obviously has been fascinated by it.
Well, how does the play work?
The play works, essentially, the setup is easy enough. It's an ambitious young black reporter comes into a major newsroom, gets a job. She starts out working in the black feature section, which she sees as being very sort of, very PC and up with people. She wants national attention. She wants the metro section. And there is a splashy murder that happens in the city. A white man is killed in a bad black section of town. And this reporter comes across a young black teen who says that she did the murder. She publishes the story. She's called into court to reveal her source. And from that, everything crumbles, both in terms of her own identity or who she said she was and misrepresenting herself to the paper, to the various ethnic and ethical conflicts that are happening on the paper itself.
Let's hear a cut.
Adrian used to come over to my house, pull on my hair, and ask me why I always acted so white. So I asked my daddy why I acted white. He said I wasn't acting white. Adrian just acted like a nigger.
Oh. Okay, that's a good example right there. Don't ever tell that story to anybody around here. Ever. Okay? Yvonne, I'm serious, ever.
If Chris Rock said that, you'd be rolling on the floor right now.
Yeah,
all right, forget it. Let's just go to dinner. And don't worry about Pat and Neil either. I'll be down with them. I'll be Mo Black. I'll be from the streets. My name is Yvonne. My game is always on. A reporter from the hood. I really think I should. Up to no good.
Now, Bill, is this story meant to portray Janet Cook herself? Or I noticed the mention of Chris Rock, and of course, he came along well after the Janet Cook story was really playing out. Or is it kind of jumping off from that story?
It's inspired by the story. It is indicating a black reporter, an ambitious black reporter who misrepresents her story. But what's going on here, of course, is that, the playwright is also investigating images of blacks that, in a sense, they are to each other and that they're representing to the public. So it's about the conflict between the bourgeois black and the ghetto black, and that tension is very real on this newspaper where there are only very few black reporters. And so, in a sense, you have two different sets of interests fighting it out in the newsroom in terms of how blacks are going to be portrayed.
How successful is the play?
I'll tell you, I think the play is a pretty interesting one. The problem with it, in a way, is that the characters are more attitudes than they are really full-fledged characters. Everyone is cynical. Everyone is lying. Everyone is an illicit stake in this story. I think the play is at its best when it makes a point about language. And at one point, a character says that the real victim of this is the truth, and the truth that can be found in language when it's used precisely and responsibly.
Now, how unusual is it for a playwright or a filmmaker to portray a journalist as a bad guy? As I remember, journalists tend to be portrayed as characters, but sort of lovable rogues in a lot of cinema and plays, right?
Well, you are a lovable rogue of lovable rogues. So, this obviously is leaving you out of it. But the journalists in films, there tends to be a polarity, as you've sort of indicated, between the front page cynical rapscallions.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all in on it, but they're all sort of amusing and funny little corrupt crooks. Then you have, on the other hand, all the president's men, where you have journalists treated as paragons of virtue.
How's it going? What are you doing?
Polishing.
You what?
Polishing.
What's wrong with it?
Nothing. It's good.
Then what are you doing with it?
I'm just helping. It's a little fuzzy.
Woodward. Bernstein, you're both on the story. Now, don't f*** it up.
Also of recent vintage, a lot of our listeners may be familiar with the film Shattered Glass. It came out last year, be released on DVD next month. That's the film about Stephen Glass, a young writer at the New Republic magazine. He ended up fabricating over 20 stories. Let's hear a quick clip from that.
You had your brother pose as George Sims.
What?
A phony recording from Juked Micronics. It's a Palo Alto number. And your brother's a student at Stanford. You had him pose as Sims.
No, Sims is a real guy.
Steve.
I've talked to him a million times, Chuck. My brother and I aren't even speaking right now.
Stop it. You faked Sims. You faked the website.
Know.
You faked all
you
those
know,
voicemails.
Chuck.
Restle,
you got this
hired,
totally backwards.
Court. It's all crap. I can trace it if you make me. I'll find it all built in.
I don't know what you're talking about, okay? Those are all real people.
They are.
Yeah.
Look at me. And say that again.
Those are all real people.
I want you out of here.
Bill, what does Shattered Glass say about journalists as villains that may distinguish it from the more possibly racial politics-driven Tracy Scott Wilson play?
Well, in Tracy Scott Wilson's play, she, in a sense, puts a curse on all houses, as I mentioned before. I mean, everybody's in on it. Mm. In Shattered Glass, actually, I think if you want to talk about influences for young journalists, I'd say that this is a lot better because, in a sense, the man is caught. I mean, Glass is caught. There is someone there who does have standards, and they are exerted. So in that sense, there is something working against what seems to be the devolution of journalism.
You got to wonder if there isn't someone out there writing a screenplay or a play or a book based around Jason Blair.
I'm sure they're working on it right now, and I'm interested to know how the Times is going to be portrayed in that. I mean, Blair himself has essentially come out and said the sort of scam that he was running. Now, we'll see whether the New York Times is going to be treated in the same way the New Republic was treated in the film Shattered Glass. In other words, as a virtuous counterforce, as someone who's willing to catch out, you know what I mean, and label the plagiarist a plagiarist, or whether... Well, we'll see whether they'll be seen as more complex.
Again, such a long way from All the President's Men, from Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant in His Girl Friday. Has something changed? Are the stakes higher for journalists now, given that they can be so highly paid, can be so famous, more so than in the past? And, of course, maybe Woodward and Bernstein started all that, didn't they? The whole cult of the celebrity journalist.
The celebrity journalist.
Didn't exist when I was coming up as a young rogue.
What goes around comes around. And I think what's happening, and I think you pointed out that as journalists have become more famous and we've become more self-conscious about the media's impact, or at least what we perceive to be its impact on what we think about the world and on how we vote politically and how we move economically, thus the stakes go higher and higher. And what we're seeing now is that there's more and more scrutiny, not just from within the journalistic organizations, which used to be in the past. If someone made a faux pas then, they were quietly disciplined. Perhaps they were moved to another paper. They were gone. Those days are long gone now. And if someone does do something this large, just sort of as Glass or as Cook, then it makes headlines.
Bill Marks, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
For more information on the new play, The Story, now on stage at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, Connecticut, check out our website at here-now.org.
How can they hear the truth above the roar? Throw them a fake and up in eagle. They'll never know you're just a bagel. Razzle dazzle them and they'll beg you for more.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Cradell, Emiko Tomagawa, Brad Fritz, Jordana Gustafson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
When you're in trouble, go into your dance. Though you are stiff.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.